Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 25th of June. What a week we've had with the weather scorching. Kev's joining us live and direct from Dubai. We'll come on to in a bit why that is, or will be revealed. All good there?
Yeah, it's very, very, very humid and hot.
Yeah,
it's not just hot, it's humid. So you walk out and it's like you just walked into the sauna.
Yeah, I've been there in June, July, and it's not even funny. I mean, July and August are ridiculous, but June, where you're starting to warm up to July, and as you say, it's like mid. I've been there when it's mid 40s, and it's like you walk half a block, and it is like swimming.
You can't walk in during the day almost anywhere. It's really quite ridiculous in terms of the humidity.
Yeah,
I mean, today it was a high of about 38, 39. I mean, to be honest with you, 95% of the time I've been indoors in the World Trade Center in Dubai.
Problem is, you can't get comfortable. You're either too air conditioned, you know what I mean? Like they over air condition it, so you're freezing when you're inside with a t-shirt, or you're, as you say, you can't even walk for more than 100 meters in it without collapsing or whatever. But yeah, it's a bizarre. I noticed Callum sounded a bit, when I spoke to him earlier, he sounded a little bit stuffed up, bunged up, as if he's sort of suffering from that typical Middle Eastern kind of, like, you know, air conditioning one extreme to the other. So, yeah.
It's been a very, very interesting week. I mean, Dubai is a bizarre place, full stop. Like, it's pretty much a man-made place, obviously, other than the small fishing village that it used to be many moons ago.
You've been there before? Like,
you know, I was here, the last time I was here, I was in the Burj Al Arab, or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
And I was watching them build the palms.
Wow.
So I was watching them put the sand into the Arabian Gulf and building it. And now, obviously, it's completely here and built and roads and everything else, you know, all on the reclaimed land that they've had. And there's obviously been billions upon billions spent here. It's unbelievable.
It's all borrowed money, isn't it? Because the state that's the wealthy one, because it's the seven states, isn't it? Is Abu Dhabi's the one that's got the money, and they're always bailing out Dubai and everything, which is bizarre. Because I don't know if you've ever been to Abu Dhabi. It's a really nice place, but it's trying to be like a mini Dubai, but they've never sort of, you know, what you find is a lot of people work in Abu Dhabi, but drive, they live in Dubai, but work in Abu, and they're constantly sort of driving this, about an hour and a half, 2 hour drive each way. So that's the commute, or that, you know, they'll stay a couple of nights in a hotel. But very interesting place, Abu Dhabi. So I've been to Sharjah as well, which is dry, but it's changed a lot. I mean, I went there first in 2001, and there was only one or two high rises, and I was going back every single year up until about 2018. And every time you went back, it was like, bang, there's another 10 buildings, another 20, another 30. I mean, it was a stat, wasn't it? It's been like 30% of all the world's cranes at one point were in Dubai. I mean, it's frightening.
Yeah, no, absolutely incredible what they've built. And I mean, I don't know. I certainly would not want to live there, that's for sure.
It's
and nothing to do with the weather. It's just full of the excesses of life, sadly. Which is really quite bizarre in an Islamic country or state. Yeah. It is like a total contradiction.
It's like Vegas of the Middle East, isn't it? If you will, you know, it's that, isn't it? Really, it's brash, it's bright, it's loud, it's and the assault on senses. It's everything materialistic. It is. Yeah, it's a very bizarre.
It's like they call Vegas Sin City. Well, this is just sick. Exactly the same. And you know, the bizarre thing I said is it's an Islamic state, which...
And they clearly turn a blind eye to some of the things that are going on there. And, you know, you approach the hotel rooms, you know, it's the oldest trade, as they say. It's an eye-opener. But anyway, should we move on to this week's news? I mean, obviously, the news has pretty much been dominated by the Ocean Gate submersible having lost contact last Sunday. It was actually Father's Day, and there was a father and son on board, sadly. Five people set off to explore the Titanic wreckage. It's obviously looks like it's ended in disaster. The US Navy has detected sounds consistent with an implosion shortly after Ocean Gate's Titan submersible lost contact during a dive to the wreck. The search mission confirmed the loss of the sub and the U.S. Coast Guard used information about the acoustic anomaly to narrow down the search area. However, the sounds were deemed inconclusive and the search and rescue mission continued. Rear Admiral Mulder of the Coast Guard confirmed that all five people aboard the Titan had been killed, likely due to a catastrophic implosion based on debris patterns. Efforts are ongoing to map the debris field and search the sea floor. The likelihood of any salvage operation is pretty unlikely when you consider the pressure that the vessel was under. And the only consolation is that it would have been pretty much instantaneous. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? It's horrific, really, isn't it? It doesn't bear thinking about.
Yeah, no, it doesn't really encourage you to go down in a submarine anyway, but the depth of it, I think people don't quite understand the pressure that thing must have been under. And by all accounts, from some of the things I've read, it was in some ways a bit of a DIY job that he put together. Obviously, DIY is a bit unfair, because I'm sure it was.
But it wasn't approved by an outside company, was it? Normally, the vessel had to go through rigorous testing and strenuous let's say acceptance tests, and it wasn't built to any specific standard. And I think somebody had already, I mean, James Cameron was interviewed earlier, the director of Titanic, who's obviously been on something like 32 missions to the wreckage in the past. And he was saying that it was ridiculous that they let that go down without any tests and without any line attached. You know, there's nothing there. If that just went and sank, I mean, literally a submersible is designed to sink. There's no other way, and they can move back to the surface with, I believe, some sort of like a PlayStation controller type thing to move it forward and back. But even then, it's like going down in a coffin, really, isn't it? And you can't even get out. You know, it's literally you're bolted in. You know, you.
Well, if you get out, you'd be squashed by the pressure immediately anyway. So
yeah,
I mean, you're way below the process of being able to survive.
Yeah.
So yeah, very sad. And then the old Bank of England increased by 0.5% this week. So that was
That was one I was going to come on to later, but we can go through it. I mean, obviously, yes, the Bank of England upped the rates 5%, as you said, and now at 5%, which was the 50 points. Some people were saying it was going to be 0.25%, but unfortunately, they had to put their foot down, didn't they, and moved it after the stubborn inflation figures remained the same, 8.7. So I think, as John Major said, if it's not hurting, it's not working, didn't he, earlier in the week? And I think that it's been a shock to many, but is it really any surprise that they've moved it up so many points?
Shouldn't be, really, when the Americans went 0.5%, 0.5%, 0.5%, or whatever it was that they did. And I can see another 0.5% in the not-too-distant future, because I think they're headed to 6%.
I think there'll be quarter movements now, a couple more maybe this year, and then into next year we'll see it move to 6%, as you say. But there was one bit which I'd written in, and I was like, I talked to you about it, didn't I? All the press over here about, is there going to be any government incentive or any help for mortgage holders who can't afford it? And they did announce on Friday, Jeremy Hunt basically came out and said mortgage holders to get 12-month grace period before repossessions amid interest rate hike. So I don't know what your thoughts on that. I think it's absolutely crazy to start bailing people out who have maybe over-leveraged on some of the, you know, maybe they were forced into buying a property during the stamp duty holiday that we saw 2 years ago. They're coming to an end. They're probably going to go on to variable rate, which is going to triple the mortgage. But ultimately, like, what point do we have to fail to improve? And like, it's almost like the system or the state now is saying, no one's allowed to fail. Now, we'll sort you out. We'll hold your hands. I just don't get the mentality of it.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Now, the 12-month thing is sort of a request from the government to the lenders. So it's not actually anybody bailing anybody out.
No.
But it is basically saying that, yeah, you can mess up and we'll give you another 12-month period.
Yeah.
And maybe it's harsh to say you mess up, but you know, you've got to take the risks when you're buying the house. If you're buying a house and your mortgage rate's 2%, and then all of a sudden it goes up to 6 or 7, then that surely should have been part of your plan when you were thinking about buying it. If you were stressed at 2%, you shouldn't have been buying the house. So, yeah, and I understand what you're saying. I think it's a nanny state situation. We're getting more and more down this line that it is a nanny state. Probably nearly every state in the world in the West is moving that way.
Yeah.
And state in the rest of the world is not moving that way. It's like,
you know, I mean, I get that banks and building societies are going to offer more flexibility for struggling, you know, people to help along. Maybe you want to take a payment holiday. Maybe you want to try and change the let's say the duration of your mortgage from, say, 25 to 30 years, or even change to interest only, which is apparently an option as well. That makes sense. But if the government start actually paying people money, I think we're in a really, really precarious, because the rental market are not going, there's no mention of that at the moment. Now, and for me, those are the people that are on the ones who have got credit problems, or, you know, maybe can't borrow the money that they need, and they could easily be evicted. So actually they stand more to, they've got more to lose being put out on the street than a mortgage holder, right?
Yeah, well, we're getting into the premise now that a huge number of people who bought property, I think late 90s, 2000s, and they rented it, and they're coming to retirement now, and that was the purpose for them to do it. So now there's a whole plethora of people who are saying, I'm selling the properties. I'm selling them. I'm not worried about the income. I'll take the capital gain and I'll take my money. Thank you very much. So those houses are now probably going to fall into the market and not be rented again. Someone's going to buy that and want to live there, because yeah, there's quite a demand now for that. So what are you going to do then? You're going to have squeeze on the whole rental market. So you could argue that actually buying property now to rent is going to be a good bet, because there isn't going to be enough. And there isn't going to be enough. They said somewhere in the region of, I think it was 600,000 to 700,000 properties are probably going to be sold because of landlords pulling out the rental. And that's partly because of government legislation as well, making it more difficult for the landlords. So it's a balancing act. And I don't think the government's getting it very, very right, basically, in this scenario.
Did you see that letter that Leeds Building signed? I think I sent it to you. Basically, they were comparing the 80s, the mortgage rates of 6.43% today, equivalent to a rate of 25.7% in 1980. And housing is now at
as a percentage of what, your income?
Yeah, well, only your income, but also the fact, you think about it, people are borrowing way, way, way more, right? So in 1980, the average UK house price was around 21,000, and mortgage costs accounted for 11.3% of disposable income. Today, with the average two-year fixed rate mortgage on offer to customers currently standing at 6.43%, those average figures are around 292,000 and 45.1% respectively. Housing is now at least its least affordable point since records began. The average home currently 9.1 times the average local wage, compared to 3.5 in 97. This particularly impacts young people. So basically, they've done a conversion and said that, you know, everyone's saying, oh my God, you remember what it was, 14%, 15% in the 80s. Well, actually, comparatively, if you take it based on what you're actually borrowing, an equivalent mortgage and an equivalent of actually the amount of money that you're taking out of your disposable income, it's actually 25.7% equivalent rate in the 80s.
Yeah, which is, was frightening, but what does it tell you about the value of property?
Do you think, yeah, the value of the property, but do you also think that it's at a point now where interest rates have been so low for so long, or not for so long, but that was not the norm? We got accustomed to the norm of low credit and low borrowing, or low interest borrowing, and actually now the norm is around the 4-5, it should be around the 4-5% historically, right?
Probably a bit higher. When we're talking about 5-6% as a tragedy, you know, going back, if you looked at the figures for probably the last 50 years, then I think we're still at the low end.
So it's not so much that we're at high interest rates, it's just that the amount we're borrowing is significantly higher, and that's what's causing the cost of living crisis.
Well, significantly higher prices to buy, and the rate of inflation on wages has not kept pace with the rate.
No, it had. The saying about the wages have gone up too fast comparatively, but not obviously in line with house prices, but they're now saying here that you can't have your wage increases as well, because that's exactly exacerbating the rate inflation issue we've had a 5%, 6% rise in wages.
Yeah, but the scenario is talking about house price. So the house price inflation, if you look at the house price inflation compared to the wage inflation, this accounts for a huge amount of that disparity of, you know, was, say, I think you said 6% of your wages, and now it's 25% of your wages. Yeah. This is where the disparity has come. You know, if somebody earns 50,000 now and they were effectively earning maybe 30,000 20 years ago, well, 30,000 20 years ago would have bought you a hell of a lot more, you know, than now. And not just because of the house price, but because of your disposable income, because everything else was cheaper. So yeah, we are going down that line, but it seems to be wherever you go in the world, this is becoming the same. I mean, I'm buying a bottle of water in Dubai. It's costing me 4 or 5 quid.
Yeah.
You know, and okay, maybe I'm in the wrong place to buy it, but even in the right place, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
And for all of these things and commodities that we want to buy and consume. So, I mean, for instance, they'll talk about it. A vape in Dubai will cost you 20 English pounds. Why? Because a vape has 100% taxation on it.
Yeah.
Okay. So rather than a vape in the UK might cost you 6, 7, 8, 9 pounds, the vape here is going to cost you maybe not 20 English pounds, maybe more like $20, but it's going to cost you a significant amount more. Why?
Yeah. So let's introduce this week's guests. We're joined by Callum Summerton, CEO of Chill Brands, and Ray Ingleby, Chairman and ND of Guest Services, 100% owner of Vaping Group. Welcome, gents. How's things?
Thanks, Phil. It's good to see you both again. How are you?
Yeah, very good. I mean, obviously, you're coming live and direct from Dubai. I believe you're at the World Vape Show. Do you want to tell us how things are going out there, how impressed you are with things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crushingly hot out here, but things are very good. We've been taking the time to meet with potential partners in the vaping industry to get a really good feel for what is happening, seeing who the movers and shakers are, you know, trying to identify any competitors that are springing up onto the scene. I think the takeaway from any of these vape shows is ultimately just how buoyant the industry is. You look at the booths, the money that's spent on producing them, the number of, you know, brands in the market that have a differentiating factor that is nothing like ours, and they're not there for, you know, a direct competitor per se, but, you know, it really is impressive to see, one, how far the technology has come and continues to move very quickly. Two, you know, the extent to which there is real hope around vaping in a continued way as a smoking cessation product. You know, I think Kev went to one of the talks on that and just saw, you know, exactly how confident the industry is in its ability to satisfy the requirement to actually be responsible, to help people quit smoking, get off tobacco, move into this new era of that kind of that category. So yeah, it's going very, very well. You know, as I say, we're taking lots of meetings, spending some time, you know, seeing what else is out there, and ultimately, of course, trying to unlock new markets for Chill.
Mm. Is it as big as it is in the UK, do you think, out there? I mean, is it still very much in its infancy? I mean, why choose Dubai for the World Vaping Conference, other than the fact, obviously, it hosts a lot of conferences, as we know, and it's got the infrastructure?
I would say that it's very much a hot market right now in Dubai, in the sense that vaping is, you know, pervasive, but it's still not quite yet refined in terms of how the market operates, in terms of routes to market, in terms of, you know, the brands that are coming. You get a lot of flash in the pan work of brands coming into this market, kind of making an initial order and then leaving. We obviously want to take a more strategy-led approach to this planet, work out what our distribution channels are in the Middle East, as we do in any country. So I would say that, yes, look, vaping is huge here, but it's still got room to grow.
So Callum, give us an overview of where we're at with Chill Brands in general right now. So we're halfway through 2023, you know, give us an idea of what's been happening from the beginning of the year to now.
You know, 2023 has all been about, you know, launching the concepts that the business is going to be built around. You know, we've moved away from our past base of business to a greater extent in kind of CBD products. Everybody knows that market has been perhaps more challenging than people expected back in the boom days of 2020, 2021. And so, look, we've been working hard, one, on the vapes that obviously we'll discuss more in this podcast, but two, also on how we can commercialize chill.com. So we've spent the last 6 months building the infrastructure around the site, making sure that it's able to carry third-party brands, third-party products, and to take, you know, to enable us to generate sales for those brands, but commissions for ourselves. So we had the news this week that we've added another 4 brands to the site in the UK. Those are sort of the maiden brands in the UK. We've got Hucks. They're a brand of nutritional supplements. They've got nootropics and sleep and a lot of sort of hydration work as well there. Headstand, it's coffee leaf seltzer that tastes nothing like coffee. It's again fitting very much with our concepts of kind of functional natural products. Verve, which is a nootropics kind of energy gum, and Mind Panda, which is all about kind of mental health and, you know, aromatherapy, things along those lines, which fits again very well with the kind of chill curated category area. The big news there alongside those brands was that we have recently signed a deal with a group that is ultimately a marketplace accelerator. They sort of call themselves. They are a brand management agency of sorts. They help take small, medium, even larger businesses out into the market, and they place them on Amazon, Kroger, Walmart, some of these large marketplace sites. One of the marketplace sites that they'll now be placing brands onto is chill.com. And that gives us a greater degree of scalability. We've been working very hard to fill our pipeline with brands, and we've got a lot of them in the hopper right now. You know, the lag in getting them onto the site is very much making sure that the quality is there in terms of their visual assets, their test reports, their insurance, as I think I've said before. But having, you know, the support of this agency and others that we'll speak to ultimately means that we're going to be fed brands over time that we can, you know, approve or otherwise put them onto the site. And getting to that critical mass is very important because I think I mentioned the more brands that are on there, the more traffic will come and the more likely they are to find at least one product that they will like, make a sale and push them into the Chill ecosystem, make us some money.
And ultimately, the more traffic that goes through that and the more sales you can make of the vapes with basically huge margins, because obviously you haven't got to pay any intermediaries, is really going to be a big driver as well, if that can work.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. So the key, of course, is that, you know, when you cross-pollinating, so you're trying to find yourself in a position where, yes, somebody might come to the site because, I'll give you an example, we rank incredibly well on Google right now for Mad Tasty, despite the fact that obviously, yeah, it's their brand, they still maintain their own website, but we rank very well. Somebody might come on for a Mad Tasty beverage pack and will then be able to dynamically screen to the bottom of their cart the products that we think will best suit them. Upsell, of course, one of those products potentially will be the Chill Zero vapes. And therefore, you know, as you say, the margins for us on our own home team product there are very, 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 very good indeed when we sell direct to the customer. They're great when we sell to the retailer and the wholesaler, by the way. But of course, when you're selling, as you say, without intermediaries, you know, you're uplifting that margin significantly.
Very good. So let's move into the UK distribution. I mean, obviously, this is the Dubai Vape Show. And joking aside, it's been that sensory overload. I think I wore my headphones yesterday because I didn't want to be overloaded with everything as well, and all the smoke from the different vapes and stuff. Even though we think it is much healthier, there's still a lot of it about in terms of the nicotine. So let's move on and talk about UK distribution. Then we can talk about the US distribution, because I think it's important that we understand that we do have an advantage there in terms of hosting. And then the potential then for the Middle East distribution.
Yeah, I mean, I think that let's bring Ray in. And before we talk about the vaping group, do you want to tell us a bit about your background, Ray? Because it's certainly very interesting.
Yeah, I will. Thanks, guys. I guess, you know, sort of self-made, I've founded and taken public three companies over the last, what I'm telling you, 30, 40 years. So I started very early, by the way, and did very well there. Also, for my sins, I bought 50% of Burnley Football Club on my journey, which has been my passion and my love, still is. Unfortunately, I don't own them now, but I was vice chairman there, which was brilliant. And I've sort of come full circle now, where I've got back into the advertising publishing business that I started in when I was 21. And as part of that, we have gained knowledge, and we bought initially a company called Vape TV, which had or has screens within hundreds and hundreds of vaping stores around the UK, which we're going to expand next year into the States. And that gives us amazing access to many, many vaping stores again in the UK. And again, we do many other things now within the vaping industry. So yeah, committed to it. And we think we know it very well. We're the market leader in the UK with some blue chip clients. You know, I suspect that probably six of the top 10 vaping brands in the world are clients for something that we do for them. So yeah, very excited, obviously getting involved with Chill on their journey now in the vaping world, which again, to us, we think it's an amazing opportunity, amazing brand. The product that's been developed now for the UK market, we helped in that by doing a lot of research with hundreds and hundreds of our customers to determine what, you know, the initial flavors should be. We did again research with hundreds and hundreds of our customers to see what the most popular flavors are at the moment. So again, the first initial grouping of vapes coming from Chill will be these flavors, and then as we continue on this journey this year, there will be other flavor categories that will be added to that. You know, the way the device looks, the size of the device. The initial device is a bigger device than the normal, which luckily Chiller allowed to do because of doing zero nic, which is going to be the initial vapes. You can do certain things you can't do for vapes with nicotine. And so, again, that's a unique selling point. We've done, again, research in the market, and there's a very interested, the buyers are very interested in looking at a zero nicotine, larger vaping device. And, you know, we believe that the market for zero nicotine will eventually be 30% of the market. The UK is the second largest vaping market in the world. It's roughly £3 billion market. And the exciting thing is that if you were to ask, you know, what could the sales be of the chilled product, then we would say that a good product in the UK market, not the best and clearly not the worst, but an average good vaping product, once it hits maturity, could do the present market size could do 5 million units just in the UK. So it becomes popular in the UK, then it's a great launch for the rest of the world. Europe, Middle East, Asia, you know, the market for vapes at the moment, there are estimates out there of about £100 billion global market for vapes. Very exciting time to anyone that's in the vaping world, and especially for Chill, as far as we're concerned.
Do you think that it's a case of that with the branding you've alluded to, you know, the quality of the branding, the zero nic element, do you think it's a case of that they've almost got a first mover advantage in that area?
Not sure if it's the first mover, but I believe it will be, if not one, the only vaping brand that goes there with a single focus, as a zero nic. There are vaping brands out there that happen to offer a zero nic product, but they focus on the nicotine products. We're going to go the opposite. We're focusing on the zero nic. Now, again, that's not to say that over time, you know, as the brand becomes more popular and people are aware of it, that you could actually do a, you know, regular product for chill, whether it's liquids or a disposable with nicotine in there. But that's obviously up to chill. And I wouldn't say it's, again, first to market anyway that way, but it'd be great to become the, you know, the elf of the zero nicotine category in the UK and then into Europe.
Yeah. So here you are, you've got this agreement in place, and obviously you're going to represent Chill Brands vape products through this direct introductions to large retailers. How do you feel that that's going? And do you feel that you can really push the product and get the sales there?
Yeah, look, we initially are going to sell the product into individual stores, convenience vape stores. You know, we have salespeople that will be going into thousands of stores this year. Also running with that will be going to selected large potential buyers, you know, the names you would know, you know, the Asdas, the Sainsbury's, the Bookers of the world. So again, we'll be doing, again, the large account sales, but as important, we have feet on the ground who will be going into thousands and thousands of shops, again, this year, tens of thousands, in fact, to introduce the product, sell the product into these stores, and then do repeat orders. That way, you know, they'll be supported by some marketing within the stores, and potentially some, you know, large events where Chill will be the sponsor, you know, getting to tens of thousands of people at any given time.
Very good. So what's your thoughts on the show here, Ray, that we've all been at? Has it been useful for the vaping group?
For us, it's been very successful up to this point. Another good day to go. You know, you've literally got, you know, someone described the yellow pages of the vaping industry here. You know, there's very few vaping companies are not here. It's quite amazing. In fact, they've said that the organisers next year, they're going to increase the footprint by 50%, which is amazing. And they already have got, I believe, 90% of the space pre-sold for this time next year, including the extra 50% of the space. To me, I was here last year, and it's evolving. It's incredible. The vaping companies are spending a lot more money on their stands, you know, communicating their products to the buyers who are here in their droves. And so it's been illuminating. We've met some, obviously we have a lot of existing clients here, but many more new potential clients. Callum has been here and pressing the flesh, and I think got some very good future contacts for Chill from here. And so again, it's been, from our point of view, and I'm sure Callum's been extremely worthwhile being here, but it just shows how still the vaping industry around the world is growing. You know, there's been some great educational speakers here, again, a lot about smoking cessation, which clearly is what certainly the UK government, why they're so supportive of it, in spite of the fact that, you know, unfortunately you've got, you know, people below 18 doing it, which, you know, is not great, which I'm sure the industry is aware of and wants to try and help clamp down on. But, you know, to when you listen to some of the speakers about how vaping saves lives, you know, I think the stat was, I think it's one out of three people that's heavy smokers will ultimately die of one way or the other of smoking. Again, it's been very illuminating to listen to that, and also how vaping, again, will save lives because it is far more safe than smoking. And, you know, hopefully it'll be a means to an end to get people to stop smoking, and also they'll probably stop vaping as well, or they'll come for no nic vapes once they've got a flavour for and used to vaping. They can then migrate to, again, to a zero nic to get some, you know, quite a few of the benefits of vaping. So again, it's been incredible show, really. And again, still today to go. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's been very interesting from my perspective, because quite obviously the vaping industry has got the message that, you know, this isn't just a product to sell for the sake of selling it. It's selling this for smoking cessation, whether it has nicotine in it or whether it doesn't have nicotine in it. The fact is, it's been proven that it's less harmful than cigarettes. So is it better to vape than it is to smoke cigarettes? Absolutely. Is it better to vape with nicotine or without nicotine? Well, without nicotine, obviously going to be safer, again, you would imagine, because it doesn't have the nicotine in it. So I can see from the lectures and the questions and answer sessions that I've attended anyway, that this is the road that the industry is going down around the world. So, I mean, what's your thoughts on that, Ray and Callum? Let's have a debate.
Look, there's obviously, you know, very important task to be completed in weaning people away from traditional tobacco products. That is something that, if you look at the annual reports of the big tobacco companies, Philip Morris, BAT, Altria, JTI, without fail, they are all backing this horse. E-cigarettes, pouches, alternative forms of nicotine delivery, and ultimately tobacco and nicotine cessation. That is what they're moving away from. You know, that is, they're moving into the category that we're trying to gain some share of. And they're also obviously supporting initiatives from the government on things like, you know, smoke-free Britain by 2030, etc. So I think, you know, look, as you say, Kevin, about the fact that people obviously want to eventually wean themselves off of even vaping. Now, the key there is you've got chemical addiction, but then also, you know, habitual addiction. People get themselves into a position where it is the oral fixation. It's the act of puffing on something. And some people will never get away with that, get away from that. They will never manage to wean themselves off of.
Maybe Callum, you.
Maybe me. No, I mean, I've been living and breathing literally the vaping world for a little while now, and you know, it's easy to see how with these nicotine based disposables, people get themselves hooked. So I'm puffing away on them all day. Luckily, I've now got a Chill Zero device in my hand, and this is a prototype, so it's not yet ready for the market. But look, I feel that there's going to be a significant contingent of people who come from, you know, smoking to vaping nicotine products, want to get themselves down, and the natural kind of conclusion, the kind of teleological end of that journey, is to use a nicotine-free vape. Some of them will then, you know, gradate themselves onto using nothing, but a good number of them will still want that. And where the rubber meets the road is, how many people do you know that, you know, after three beers want to buy a packet of cigarettes or puff away on something or sit in a beer garden? You know, it's habitual, it's kind of recreational, it's social. It's something that is kind of deeply ingrained into our society, the use of these types of products. We just want to offer one that is less harmful, not chemically addictive, and, you know, ticks all the right boxes in terms of the quality and safety so that people can trust it.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your thoughts, Ray?
Again, not having ever been a smoker, or fortunately not ever being a vapor, I can't give a perspective really on that. But, you know, vaping's here to stay. You know, it's growing rapidly in countries where are very big smokers. Sort of makes sense, doesn't it? You know, the Middle East, certain Asian countries. So that's, again, that's growing like wildfire, the markets over there. I think what I've learned from here is the vaping industry, as you said, are very now mindful of their role they've got now in the world and health, and we'll be promoting that more. Again, one of the other things is the, you know, the waste element of these disposables. And I think, again, that will be dealt with over time. The chill product, you know, the product's going to be, certainly for initial two products, are going to be 1,500 and 3,000 puffs. And what that means is that the normal market for a disposable is 600 puffs. So the device is going to be a lot bigger, which is great for the environment, because it's, you know, less waste. It's going to be, again, zero nick. It's going to sell, it's going to, you know, wholesale for a lot higher price than a regular vape product, which means the margins are way better than the normal, which is great clearly for chill. I get it, there's not that many large devices out there.
Just to clarify, when you say large product, it's exactly the same size pretty much as 600.
Yeah,
correct. If it happens, the puff size is greater. Yes.
Yes. So just to elucidate on that a little bit, Kev, so you're absolutely right. As a result of the Tobacco Products Directive and associated now retained law in the UK, but also across various parts of Europe, a nicotine-containing disposable device cannot have a liquid tank of more than 2 milliliters. Now, we don't have a nicotine-containing device. That is exactly our point. And therefore, we have got a device that looks and feels like the disposables that have become so popular, but ultimately has a larger tank, a larger battery capacity, and the ability overall to, you know, to last for longer. So you're looking at, as Ray says, 1,500 puffs, 3,000 puffs. You know, I've been speaking with people here at the show who've gotten themselves up to a 10,000 puff and beyond. And, you know, those are bigger devices, but ours look and feel like the products that you're seeing on the market today. So, you know, we are equipped legally in terms of our equipment as well, but also in terms of our market positioning to really hammer home and deliver a product with a USP as compared to what people are used to at the 600 level.
Good. It's an interesting concept, this, because we've been having this discussion while we've been here as well, Cara, about a race to the top with the number of puffs. I almost gave it to the same analogy of having a 100 million megabyte camera or something, you know, as opposed to 12 million, which was actually more than enough for what people needed. Was that the bigger the number becomes, I think people could start to get bored of that particular flavor over a long period of time. So I think there's going to be an optimal number of puffs, you know, that you'll be happy to have this many puffs, and then, you know, you'll move on either to the next flavor or you get a new device, if you like. So I think for the market, obviously, to work out in terms of what's actually going to happen in people's mentality. Yes, they're going to get a cheaper device, basically, aren't they? Because 3,000 puffs is going to cost how much?
A 3,000 puff device to the consumer, Kev.
Yeah.
I will tell you. In fact, I won't tell you. You'll have to wait and see. But it is ultimately, you know, significantly more expensive than the very, very cheap end products, which is why, you know, when we look at, you know, Mike, who runs the vaping group, he talks about removing the product from the pocket money spend category. It's elevating it up so that actually somebody can buy it. It costs them a little bit more. It's, you know, a bit over the £10 mark per unit, but it lasts longer. And, you know, it's ultimately, you know, within that range where somebody can pick it up, keep it for days, a week, however long it happens to be. And you're right as well that, you know, people don't necessarily want to get up to those massive puff counts in the disposable category. So, yeah, I think if you bring it all together, look, we've got something that costs a little bit more, but for that cost, you get something that's better for the environment, potentially, in terms of, you know, wastage and turnover of these devices. You get something that will last longer. We've got charging ports in our largest device so that you can really take confidence in the battery, because you know that the battery's not going to run out before the fluid. You can recharge it if you need to. So there's lots of different ways to effectively make the product deliver on its promise to the consumer. And of course, we want to take as many of those opportunities as we can.
My logical mind was very much along the lines of, okay, the cheapest end of the vape market, I don't know how much it is, to be honest. Let's say it's £2, £3, £4, £5 for 600 puffs. How much is this likely to be per 600 puffs? As in 3,000 is five, 600 puffs.
Yeah. I think I could answer that. You know, again, we're not finalised the pricing just yet, but based on what we believe out there, you know, I think you can have a product that sells anywhere between £12 to £16 at retail. So if it was done mathematically, you've got a 3,000 puff, it's five times the average price is, say, £6, that's £30. It's not going to be £30. I believe it's going to be somewhere between £12 and £16. So a huge benefit to the consumer. But again, it's not been finalized yet, but I would argue that's sort of where we'd be.
And what I'd add to that, Kev, as well, is that it also very much will be geared towards the markets that we enter. And of course, we don't want to overextend ourselves. We have to succeed in the UK, and you know, the US will continue to grow as well. But the key is that, you know, we'll be tailoring what we're doing in terms of our strategy, our flavors, our device, our pricing for the markets that we enter. And, you know, we've been talking about the Middle East a lot, of course, but, you know, while we've been here, look at the vaping shows that are coming up over the course of the next sort of 12 months. Paraguay, Poland, Azerbaijan, Asia, South America. There is still a lot of life in the early stages of the vaping industry. Countries are coming online in a very sophisticated way now. They're starting to regulate. They're starting to find ways to actually push these products out to the masses in a way that's safe. And, you know, that's only going to continue for the foreseeable future. And as we sort of turn our minds to each of these various territories as we go along, we'll be tailoring our strategy accordingly.
Yeah, and Egypt in 2 weeks' time as well, again. So, yeah, I mean, there is huge potential that of this, there is no doubt. Yeah, we leave it in your capable hands, Ray, and the vaping group's capable hands to go and sell these little beauties that hopefully will make chill very, very cash generative and very, very profitable. You know, there is no doubt the margins on these products are very, very healthy, both from the point of view of the company and also from the point of view of the retailer. No retailer has hardly any product, if any, in its store that it's going to make 100% margin. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, look, again, last thing I'll say, this is the pricing, is that, again, retailers like to make where they can 100%. They don't necessarily make it on all of their vaping products, but again, they should make 100% markup on this. So if you were to work backwards, you know, to sell it out anywhere from £12 to £16, so they're making a very healthy margin, which they're going to love. That's why they're going to buy. One of the reasons they're going to buy this product. Again, the manufacturers of vapes like to make at least 100%. So, you know, one can draw your own conclusions on how well this will be, how well it'll be for chill. Again, you know, and again, we can't guarantee the sales, but again, as I repeat, the average good product in the market, once it hits maturity in the UK at the current market size, which is growing, is roughly 5 million devices. So again, you can draw your own conclusions to, once this is successful, please God it is, then the sort of money and the cash flows that it will benefit to chill. And again, we're at hopefully the beginning, which is the UK, which is, you know, second biggest market in the world, but a fraction of the potential global vaping market.
Yeah. On that note, actually, before we go, being it's a Sunday roast, something we always ask guests, and we've asked Callum before, so I think he'll sit this one out, I'm sure. Ray, what is your ultimate Sunday roast? Obviously, the weather's warming up. You're in hot Dubai, but a traditional Sunday roast.
Like most people, you know, Yorkshire pudding or roast. I like my meat done very well, which tends to really annoy chefs of restaurants I go to, and honestly, it's embarrassing, especially when
the Irish way, as we say.
Yeah,
there ain't no blood on that plate, I'm sure.
Absolutely correct. So yeah, very traditional, very boring. I love that the roast on a Sunday, and yeah, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. It's been great being on here. Obviously, on this, I've not been on this before. You know, hopefully we'll be on it again. So thanks, guys. It's been great.
Look forward to it as well, Ray, because I know you've been speaking to me that your own gut company is hopefully going to list in the not too distant future. So we'll look forward to talking to you maybe on the roast and giving everybody an idea of the whole of guest services worldwide at some point. So we look forward to that.
Callum and Ray, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Okay, let's move on to this week's movers and shakers. One that's popped up on the radar is Strip Tinning. Don't know a massive amount about the company, but they've moved 75% on not much news. There was news of a director buy Maybe it was oversold, but that one sort of hit the radar. I need to do a bit more research on it over the coming weeks. E-Star, what happened to E-Star, Kev? I saw there was some, was it some news on the rare earths? I mean, maybe you can elaborate on that. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I had minor conversation with Alex, the CEO there at E-Star, and yeah, it's been punished severely for basically not coming out with Stella. Yes, everything is hunky-dory. But actually what they did was the rare earths were sampled, and on simple leaching, it didn't work. With acid leaching, it did work, but more work was required to find out whether this was going to be economical for them to do. So this then plummeted the share price 40%. So I suppose the story of E-Star is you've got gold prospects still there, but miles away probably from actually anything happening. For me, I am an investor in E-Star and still am. The rare earth was the big one. I really did think it was going to be great. But speaking to the CEO previously, they were not saying the rare earth was the big one. The copper was the big one. And the copper is there. So we're now basically looking at E-Star and saying it's a copper play. They have copper. They effectively have an exploration jork, I think, on the copper. And they're going to start drilling very soon for the copper. So if you want a copper play in Kazakhstan, you have a market capitalization.
Said no one ever.
Said no one ever is right. You have a market capitalization of £3.3 million. So, you know, it is in absolute bargain territory. But where you had three bets before, I think you've only got one now.
Yeah.
The copper may well be the making of the company. And in all honesty, if that copper is there in the levels that they're talking about, then this company will be a £30-40 million company. I don't doubt that in terms of its quantity and its ability.
Yeah.
But sadly now, people are saying, I think people are saying you've only got one chance now. Now, maybe that's a bit unfair, and the market is definitely unfair, because interestingly, when the results of the copper was announced, the share price didn't go up, but the bad news for the rare earth comes in and it gets shattered. So I think that just tells you, you know, the market is still hypersensitive to bad news and not really very sensitive to good news, you know?
We saw that on Friday. It comes on nicely onto the BSF because we saw a good announcement from BSF Enterprise on Friday, which had a great impact initially. But then within about an hour and a half of the news being out, it just did the usual trickle back down to sort of, I think it was about 20-25% up at one point, maybe 22%, and it finished the day around 6.5% up, which is, don't get me wrong, is still good in this market, but it just shows you that there was a lot of sellers there, unfortunately, or profit takers, which, you know, what can we do? But basically the news came in, I don't know if you saw it, it was basically the announcement that the cultivated meat has been approved for sale in the USA, marking a significant milestone for the industry. Two cultivated meat companies were mentioned, Upside Foods and Eat Just. They've also received regulatory approval from the USDA and FDA to sell their cultivated chicken products to US consumers. This validation of cultivated meat as a viable and safe alternative to conventional meat in one of the world's largest meat-consuming markets opens the door for other countries to follow suit and for further commercialization of cultivated meat. BSFA subsidiary 3D Biotissues aims to partner with cultivated meat producers and provide its patented serum-free and animal-free cell booster CityMix to help scale up production. So great RNS. I think that approval there is just exactly what was needed. And I actually did a bit of research on those two companies. Upside Foods are the one that's got Bill Gates as a bit of a backer. They're both private entities at the moment, looking to potentially list in the future an IPO. But I did a quick look, and Eat Just was mulling over a $3 billion IPO to make this cruelty-free food mainstream. I mean, that just boggles the mind.
$3 billion, bizarre. I mean, it's not bizarre in the US market. This is the
thing. That's what I mean.
That's why BSFA is, you know, and the broken oak said it is significantly undervalued based on its tech, on its potential. Obviously, I tasted the meat. I've seen the meat. I've smelt the meat that they've grown. And they also have the other option as well, which the other companies don't seem to be following, which is the skin or the leather.
Yeah,
and also the corneas as well, the ability to grow the corneas, which is going to help people's eyesight. So it's multifaceted as well. And Yeah, and I think it is basically at a pretty low valuation. It raised at 17p and now it's sitting at 13p, and it was sitting at lower than that, I think 12p.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there is huge potential for that, and I think if they get it right, yes, the company could be worth, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But will the market agree? Will the market put the money there? Who knows?
Yeah. Okay. So we also had Galileo Resources on Friday providing an update on the progress of Afrimat Limited's option to purchase shares and shareholder loans in Glenover Phosphate Proprietary Limited. What did you make of that RNS?
Well, I thought it was very good, but sadly it pushes it down the line a bit, doesn't it? I mean, effectively they're going to get shares very shortly, which is sort of half payment. But the cash element of the thing doesn't come until April next year, I think it is. So, I mean, that will soon come around, I suppose. You know, you're only talking about, what, 10 months and not even 9 months away before they receive the cash. And then there's a very small amount, which is dependent on something to do with Glenover. I think it's only 3 million, I think, whatever the currency is in South Africa. So the rand, it's only 3 million rand. And they're only getting 20% or 21% of that. So it's only 100 and something thousand pounds. I think it's good. I think it puts pay to speculation that is it coming, is it not coming? It's coming. And this is the deal that's been knocked out. If the share price does well, then it's going to be a masterstroke that they got shares, you know? So we will see. We will see how it happens. But it's a good deal. And ultimately, this is a legacy asset. And Galileo has a huge number of assets.
So Audio Boom had an RNS this week. They talked about sales and adjusted EBITDA. They're expected to be lower than previously thought this year due to poor advertising environment. Company are confident that there will be growth from last year. Audio Boom saw a record 135 million downloads across 8,007 podcasts globally in May. Company has $5.2 million cash to invest in further growth. So they've done really well since they've come to market. Obviously, they've dropped back a lot from the highs, but it's interesting that they're expecting those sales and just the EBITDA to be lower than they previously thought. You think that podcasts are more booming now, a lot more people are listening to them, that your sales would be up.
Yeah, we use their service and it's very good, isn't it? It's very efficient. We haven't had any problems with it at all. So I think it's a good prospect, and it's a good prospect going forward as well, you know. So we'll see. So
the other one, and we can talk about it, you can add a bit of colour to it, is Acuity Risk Management. They announced the retirement of Simon Marvel as CEO of its subsidiary, Acuity Risk Management Limited, effective from the end of June. Marvel will not stand for re-election as a director of the company at the AGM on June the 27th. So that allows Kerry Chambers, the current COO of Acuity, selected as Marvel's successor, and will assume the role of CEO on July the 3rd.
I think it's a good move, and I also think basically it's as it was, if you understand what I'm saying. I think for the last period of time, she's been operating the company anyway, very efficiently. You know, chief operating officer, effectively the day-to-day control of everything. I think she's been doing this for a while. And I think she's a very driven woman from speaking to her. She's very amicable. And also, I think in this market, they will get more and more and more contracts. And every contract is basically going to make them exponentially more profitable with the hold on the contract, 96% renewal or whatever it is, and decent sized contracts. So, and in this particular market, and in this particular IT side of the market, the way that the companies are valued is significant on the revenue, you know. So I see that the valuation there currently at the minute is pretty low for what they've managed to do. So I think the appointment is going to be welcomed. Didn't really have much of a reaction, I don't think, on Friday, but I think as the contracts start to be added again, I can't see anything but this sort of ticking up. I don't see it ticking down anyway. It's very tightly held, and as they win more and more contracts, I think the salespeople were at shows this week in terms of trying to get more contracts. And yeah, I don't really see much of a downside in this particular company. And I know you shouldn't say that.
No, it's held up pretty well, hasn't it, of late, when you think about the move from the sort of low or mid fours to the 10p was paid, wasn't it, for quite a, you know, maybe a period of 2 days. It was sort of testing the 9.5s, the 10s, and then it's dropped back to, I think, around the 8.75, 8.6 mark on Friday close. But it's holding in that range pretty well. It's consolidating well, isn't it? And it's always healthy to see a bit of consolidation.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be news driven. It's going to be one of those shares that is news driven. You know, as it's tightly held, it is. So what after hearing what Callum said and what Ray Ingleby said, what was your take on it, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if we can get these, use the vaping group to get the products out into all these stores and get the distribution right, then, and you know, it's all down, the proof's in the pudding now, isn't it? They've got the product. It's about getting it out there and getting the sales in for me.
Yeah. Well, I spoke to Ray this afternoon, actually, after we'd done the podcast, because I wanted to firm him up on a few details. So effectively, I think Chill are starting with 6 people full-time in Salesforce to put the vapes out across the UK. And the normal anticipation is that they will have the vapes in 1,000+ stores within, I think it's sort of 6 to 9 months, based on individuals going into each store, talking to them, placing the product in store, and then, you know, obviously following up and going for the restocking side of things. And on top of that, I mean, you know, they do already have brands that are in some of the big names he talked about as well. So if you're already in those and you just offer an alternative product, which is the nicotine free, as opposed to do you want nicotine, da 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 da, probably a harder sell to go in and put lots of nicotine brands in the one place. You know, is a supermarket going to want to carry 20 brands of nicotine vapes? Probably not. But if there is no nicotine vape in those places, which there isn't, then it's going to be not necessarily an easy sell, but I think there's a very, very good chance there's going to be some big hitting things coming along. So yeah, I'm optimistic. And also, it's been great to spend 3-4 days with Callum, just, you know, talking constantly pretty much about what's been happening and what needs to happen and what can be done. And yeah, even going around the vape show, we were talking about, you know, the quality of the product and how we can improve it. And I suggested, you know, that we have a better cardboard that's used on the box, so that it comes across as a premium product. You know, and we saw that in the show, that it was premium products and not just cheap crap. You know, and a lot of that was to do with the packaging, how well the packaging was done, and so on. So yeah, lots and lots of things to think about. And you know, there are lots of people out there, and there are lots of brands. But whether you like it or not, Chill as a brand, I think, is excellent. And Chill.com. I mean, he did tell me the number that got in the pipeline for products, and it was really shocked me how big it is. You know? So yeah, I think we've got some excitement ahead of us, and we'll see where the fundamentals of that company takes us.
Just one that popped into mind I saw in the week, which was quite impressive, actually, was, I don't know if you saw it, was Ocado. Obviously, the online delivery, you know, that they used to resell Waitrose. I think they've now got Marks and Spencer products on board, but they're a massive online reseller for groceries. And they are one of their most heavily shorted stocks on the FTSE 100, okay? And the Times published an article on at midnight on Thursday, into sort of Wednesday into Thursday morning, basically entitled, Ocado Rises as Rumours of Bid Interest Circulate. So you can imagine what happened on the start of trading on Thursday, as all those shorts started to get squeezed and closed down. It rose 45%, which for a FTSE 100 stock is not your normal daily swing, is it? Let's face it. It was phenomenal. I was watching it on sets, and it was going off. It was it wasn't really in that it was going off in any higher volume. It was just the way that as these shorts were closing, because it was logging them up. Obviously, they're buys, aren't they? You know, you're buying them back. It was just literally moving up so quickly on every trade. It was phenomenal. Very impressive.
Yeah, shows that shorts can get burnt.
Exactly that.
I mean, it can be an
experience. But also on a bid rumor as well, on something that you don't know whether it's a credible rumor or not. You know, we don't know who created that, but we just know that it was one of the most heavily shorted stocks because of its performance hasn't been great of late. But yeah, the gap was there, and as you say, there was a short squeeze on, and bang, off it went.
Yeah, interesting.
So on that note, I mean, what else is going on? Is any sports? I mean, the Ashes was a disaster. I mean, what are your thoughts? For me, I don't know. Should Stokes have declared not? It was obviously, it's hindsight, it's wonderful, but I thought at the time, has he done enough?
I don't think it was a bad move. I really don't. From a cricketing point of view, he was basically saying, right, I'm going to put you in and I'm going to rattle you for 12 overs or whatever it was that was left. So I don't think it was a bad idea. But at the same time, if they had two wickets left and they'd added another...
If he'd have got another 50 to 100 runs, it would have been a very different thing.
Yeah, but also he could have got another two or three runs. But then he would have had the same situation, but maybe psychologically he wouldn't have... I mean, it was a psychological move, wasn't it? It wasn't just let's do it. It's like, we're on the attack, we'll do this. And they nearly had the Australians at one point in the first innings of the Australian... And then they got away from them, didn't they? And then the lead was only minor. I don't think it was a disaster. I think it was a good game and unlucky that we lost, really. But such is life. There you go. No, there's not much football about, is there? I mean, there's all sorts of talk about who's going where and how much stupid money does somebody want to pay for somebody who plays football. And that's about it that's going on at the minute.
There's a bit of tennis on. Obviously, it's hotting up for Wimbledon coming across. I think they're at it's Queens, isn't it, at the moment for that. They have Queens and then obviously getting ready for Wimbledon, which I always enjoy going to. I must admit, it's one of my favourite events on the sporting calendar, certainly the summer events where you can go down to Wimbledon and I just love walking around, even not necessarily being on centre court, which I've been on a few times, but just being on some of the sort of periphery courts where you can watch some amazing tennis and just relax. The weather's good, Pims or some, you know, strawberries and cream. It's just a lovely environment to be in. So fortunately I'm away this time when it's on, but I'll certainly try and get back down there next year.
Yeah, something I've never been to. But actually, when you watch tennis close up, as opposed to being in the big stadiums, I'm sure it's a better look. You know, it's a better view. You see them smashing it, and it's close. But yeah, it's a great event, obviously, and it signals strawberries in summer, doesn't it, in the UK. So yeah. All good.
All right, good. Well, on that note, I'll say thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back next week with some more roast material.
Indeed, thanks for listening, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.